Hello and welcome to the Payments Journal podcast. Bankers in the audience, open your ears. Today's discussion is for you. We have Wes Suter, Director of Product Solutions at Fiserv, discussing the best ways for traditional banks and credit unions to compete against neobanks. Joining Wes is Mercator Advisory Group's own Director of Debit and Alternative Products, Sarah Grotta, who opens the conversation highlighting the data surrounding neobank adoption. It's not to be trifled with. However, cracks have begun to emerge, regulation and scaling challenges. Next, Wes puts the driving forces and trends in neobanking adoption in context, and finally identifies the marquee challenge that neobanks pose to traditional finance, which is an existential risk to transaction volume. And lastly, Wes and Sarah discuss what credit unions and traditional financial institutions can do about it. Without further ado, let's go to the show. Sarah, if you would start off our conversation with a quick overview.
Yeah, thanks, Ryan. You know, from my vantage point, I think that the rise of neobanks or digital-only banks has undeniably altered the retail banking environment. And I think challenged the way that the industry thinks about customer or member experience. You know, many of them with their mobile first approach, these non-banks have attracted an amazing number of account holders. I was just doing a little bit of research and found that Chime is looking at over 13 million account holders. Current has about 4 million. Aspiration and Varo have about 3 million apiece. So this is a big part of the financial services space. And what we find too, when we look at some of the survey data that we have at Mercator Advisory Group, these aren't just extra or secondary accounts either. We find that about 67% of these digital-only primary account owners say that in their mind, they perceive this account to be their primary account. And the number one reason that consumers are telling us that they opened a digital-only bank account was due to the ease and the convenience of the digital experience. But, and there is a but here, we also find that there is starting to be some cracks in the neobank model as these companies and their products really start to mature. So some of the things that I'm hearing about is some are having a little bit of greater regulatory scrutiny, which is requiring them to sort of change some of their activities. Some are experiencing issues as they try to scale, you know, leading to things like systems outages that might even prevent consumers from having access to their account information or maybe even their funds. And some are having difficulty shifting towards a model that will put them on a path to profitability. In part due to these issues, I think consumers also have a little bit of hesitancy sort of committing 100% to these new bank types. Again, going back to some of our data, we found that over 70% of those consumers that have a digital-only bank account with one of these non-banks also retain a relationship with a traditional bank financial institution or credit union. So that's kind of how I'm seeing what's happening in the space. And Wes, I wanted to turn it over to you and kind of see from your vantage point, you know, what you're seeing happening in consumers' use of digital-only banks.
Sarah, thanks for that tremendous insight. And I'm gonna hone in on a conversation that you brought up. I think a lot of these neo-challenger banks have cracked the code at what consumers are seeking, which is that ease of use and convenience factor that you mentioned. That's really where consumers are thriving when it comes to financial services, but really all aspects of their kind of more digital-centric lives. And these digital-first banks are leveraging kind of an existing infrastructure, right? I mean, our consumers in the United States and elsewhere have their head buried into their smartphone, instant access via their fingertips to data and the entirety of their financial experience. And so they combine that existing infrastructure by orchestrating very high-end experiences. And so that's how they kind of create that ease of use and convenience. And at Fiserv, we talk about ease of use and convenience as really the new form factor of loyalty. Like if you can make it easy on a consumer, if you can make that experience convenient for them, you're going to be able to retain that relationship long term. Now, what I also think is kind of interesting related to this digital-only FI space is oftentimes how these institutions began. And I'll give you a couple examples. Oftentimes, they were narrowly focused on solving a market problem. You take SoFi, for instance, kind of a very niche player to begin with, looking at how to solve some student loans. It was really from there where they manifested into other financial services, offering things like mortgages and insurance and ultimately payments, which is really my area of interest. And then you look at somebody like Chime, right? They, by all intents and purposes, were more of a traditional pathway, kind of looking at and offering all financial services across the spectrum. But again, hyper-focused on that digital experience, how to make it convenient, how to make it easy for that end user. Now, we are all kind of products of our environment, right? So, you know, I think it's interesting where these digital only institutions began from and where their market presence has started and where it's grown. And I'll give you kind of my own personal anecdote here as I think about my family and kind of the generational impact that banking has had. And I go back to my grandparents. And my grandparents, like probably many of our grandparents, were Depression era generation. I'm sure they banked. I don't exactly know where they banked. But what I do know explicitly is that they had cold hard cash kind of stored around their house. That was their perspective. And then we fast forward to my generation, and I would consider my age kind of mid-career age, if you will. And I don't recall having access online to my banking environment probably until my mid-20s. So it was more of a learned trait to start to do things more digitally. And then we look into the younger demographic, even kind of my kids as I've started a family, and you think about their perspective on life and certainly how it'll impact their banking experience, where they're fully immersed digitally, right? What we call being digitally native at that age. You know, we've got kids in the neighborhood cutting grass, shoveling snow off a driveway. We're paying them via Venmo or Zelle. So their perspective is considerably different. And these institutions are kind of leaning into that comfort zone. And so final note, I think about my kids, and it will be as foreign to them going into a branch and having that face-to-face interaction is about as foreign as it was for me those first few times that I was logging into my online account.
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. And I think one thing that I really, really appreciate that you said, and I think these words to live by, is that convenience equals loyalty. I think that's a really concise way of sort of presenting the concept.
Awesome. So, you know, Sarah detailed the significant volume of attraction for that consumers are putting towards neobanks and digital alternatives. You know, Wes was touching on some of how these services originated as solving a market problem with the digital experience and sort of now proliferating out. Love the point around convenience equaling loyalty. I'm curious though, Wes, what caused the shift? What are the driving forces that sort of pushed consumers towards seeking digital alternatives to traditional finance?
Yeah, in many respects, I think consumers were already naturally trending towards this direction, kind of organically becoming more and more comfortable in a advanced digitally centric life that I mentioned earlier. But like many industries, financial services included, there was an accelerant within these last 2 or 3 years, a fuel on the fire, if you will, with COVID-19. And when I sit in and consult with my community financial institutions, I often describe this phenomenon as being forcibly reconditioned, right? So consumers are being forcibly reconditioned to reevaluate all aspects of their lives. And for example, if we look at the financial services sector, this concept plays out when we were in the height of COVID. Those constituents, that segment of your consumer base that preferred that in-branch channel, they had to figure something else out. Branches were closing. Those that wanted to do banking face-to-face had to think about alternative forms of banking. They either had to call into the call center, they had to log in to their online or mobile banking channels. It literally forced them to reevaluate, you know, how they banked. And this manifested and had parallels in other industries as well. We had education, you know, at-home learning for that particular industry. We were creating doctor's visits via Zoom calls. The retail locations for merchants, those that were still open, were literally dissuading the use of cash as a form of payment. and promoting alternative forms, digital wallet usage like Apple and Google Pay and Samsung Pay, or highlighting the fact that they've got a touchless terminal. So all of these things were natively happening, but the accelerant was certainly, you know, the impact that COVID had. Additionally, it is my belief that this concept of connected commerce has also had a real strategic impact in how consumers view digital. And again, kind of drawing a parallel to other industries. Our lives are kind of fully immersed now, all things digital. Everything's always on. It's instant linked to the rest of the world. It's impacted how we work, how we socially interact with others, how we access and consume entertainment, to how we actually pay for goods and services. So when we peel that back to more functional type of use cases, we ask ourselves, why can't my banking experience be as easy as other aspects of my life? Again, I had this kind of manifest in my own personal experience, and it relates to kind of that grocery vertical. And pre-pandemic, my wife and I would wake up on Sunday, we'd clip out the coupons of the Sunday newspaper, we'd gather our grocery list, and we'd go to the store, and you start out in the deli, and you're, you know, checking the thickness of the cheese slice, you're going to the produce and picking out your produce, you go into the central aisle where all the staples exist. And that process was about a two-hour window of time that it took us to get through the store. And increasingly, it became a more inconvenient process, especially as, you know, we had kids and started a family. What I noticed is that the grocery channel started to introduce little tiny use cases around digital. You had digital couponing. You had the ability to order ahead for your deli meat and cheese. But it wasn't really until the onset of the pandemic that you really started to see the uptick in things like buy online, pick up in store within that grocery channel. So the pandemic, just like many other industries, it really accelerated that. And we, as a family, were forcibly reconditioned to think about how do we buy groceries differently? And what's important to us? Can I trade off that 2 hours of loitering around the grocery store for something that's a little easier? Well, I'm not going to be able to pick out my produce, and I kind of wanted to keep a pulse on that, but I'm going to trade those 2 hours and get that time back for my family. What's convenient? Well, I can order my groceries now, whether it's Friday night or Saturday morning or whenever I have a window, I can do that at my leisure and my moment of need. And then what's easy? And this is really where the connected commerce aspect comes in, where I can set up my account, I can tie my preferred method of payment to that relationship and have a frictionless checkout experience. Instead of peering around the last aisle and seeing which lane is the leanest, I can set it and forget it, and my order is completely checked out. So we've seen kind of examples across all industries where they've leveraged digital to really accelerate that important factor of making it easy for consumers, making it convenient, and then really connecting the dots. And again, those digital only institutions, they're pulling on that thread. They've got a hyper focus on the experience, and they understand how to connect the intersection of digital journeys to payments and banking.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's so easy to overlook, or I'm not sure if take for granted is the right word combination, but like how much we as consumers, how much change we've absorbed. Right on. Wes, if we were going to turn it around here, if we're going to turn the conversation on its ear a little bit, consumer expectations, consumer experiences have totally changed. How is this impacting issuers, or maybe how are our card issuing banks responding to the change?
Well, I would start with helping issuers understand the implications of what's at stake. And I, again, have sat in thousands of boardrooms and talked to, you know, leaders of these tremendous financial institutions. And what I try to convey to them is really that importance of the payment relationship. And the payment relationship is really the gateway to all the other products and services that an institution provides, especially the debit and credit card relationship, where really, if you think about it, those are the furthest extension of an institution's brand. It is what businesses and consumers are all walking around with. It is by far the most used channel at your organization, more than coming into a branch, more than accessing online or mobile banking. It is used more than anybody calling into your call center. So the most existential risk, I would say, would be a loss of transactions. The imputed impact of a loss of transactions is both in interest and non-interest income, right? So from revolving balances to interchange revenue, but ultimately, if you lose that payment relationship, you're at risk for losing the overall banking relationship. So I try and emphasize to clients that, you know, this idea of connected commerce, the payment experience, the digital experience, these are all intersecting at the same point and kind of really highlighting the importance of building highly curated digital experiences around those aspects.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I know, you know, when I talk to financial institutions, one of the things that I talk to them about getting an understanding of is paying attention to, you know, where and how their customers and members are making payments today. Step back, do a little analysis and see what's coming through, you know, say your ACH system, or see what's hitting the accounts, you know, is how much PayPal and Venmo and other types of activity are actually flowing through these accounts already. And that can help, I think, to sort of prioritize, you know, some of the use cases and, you know, really where to start to take a look at providing the right digital experience.
So Wes, then how can brick and mortar financial institutions respond? Like what's the counterstroke?
Yeah, again, great question. I think someone listening might gather that from this discussion, traditional institutions and issuers had somehow like completely transitioned to digital only. And that's absolutely not what we're saying. I think, again, how I consult with our clients is to lean into how you as a traditional institution win today. You have worked effortlessly to build this affinity of your brand. Your consumer base and business base trust you to protect them, to protect their money. And you provide a very high touch personal service excellence to your customers and members. So lean into those things and take those three attributes, but supplement it again with elevated digital experiences. And I always go back and I say, ask yourself as the leader of your financial institution from an acquisition strategy, can my consumers easily open an account and get a debit or credit card so we can capture that purchase activity instantly? Can they perform actions in a self-service environment? I gave you that buy online, pick up in store grocery example. That's a self-service example of where we could, you know, use that type of engagement, that digital experience within our banking and payments lives. And then are we making it easy for them to manage their financial lives in that moment of need? And so we can solve many of these problems digitally, but again, leaning on your brand affinity, your trust factor, and that high touch service environment that you offer to your consumers. The final kind of guiding principle that I often recommend or have financial institutions consider is to understand the new benchmark of how you're evaluated. With all the proliferation of digital experiences around us throughout all the other industries that we find ourselves each and every day, your product is no longer necessarily the products and services you offer. Your product is really about the experience consumers and businesses have with your brand.
That makes a lot of sense. And yeah, you know, I do think that when we think about the branch network, the brick and mortar, you know, that is also a competitive advantage against the neobank, challenger banks, and digital only banks. And we find too that even those consumers who identify as, you know, very tech forward, in fact, are utilizing a lot of the digital payment solutions, they are also users of brick and mortar and need that touch with individuals and appreciate the service that they provide. So it's not a one single solution. It's a combination of both.